Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, reaction to North Korea's claim of a nuclear test. Our Moscow correspondent joins us to discuss Russia's offer to mediate the Iran-Saudi dispute. We'll take a virtual stroll through the 2016 Consumer Electronics Show.
It's like all the building block pieces have come together towards artificial intelligence, robotics, drones, driverless cars.
And take a look back at entertainers we lost last year, but who live on in their music. It's right here on The Voice of America. North Korea says it has conducted a successful hydrogen bomb test. The announcement on state television called the test a matter of self-defense to protect the country's sovereignty and made several critical references of the United States. It came less than a month after North Korean leader Kim Jong-un claimed his country had developed a hydrogen bomb, which is far more powerful than an atomic bomb. The United States and others quickly discounted his claim, and on Wednesday, South Korean intelligence officials and nuclear experts said, given the size of the explosion, they seriously doubted it was a true hydrogen bomb. North Korea conducted three previous nuclear tests in 2006, 2009, and 2013. All of them took place in the same area, where several monitoring agencies detected man-made earthquake activity today. On the line with us is the executive director of the Arms Control Association, Daryl Kimball. Welcome, Daryl.
Thank you.
So, you're the man of the hour. What is your reaction to North Korea's alleged test?
Well, it is a nuclear test by all the early indications. It is extremely troubling. This is yet another wake-up call that the North Korean nuclear weapons program is moving forward, not at a great pace, but with every nuclear test explosion, scientists are understanding more about how to miniaturize nuclear warheads. And if the United States and our allies don't arrest their progress and re-engage the North and get the North to agree to exercise restraint, they are going to be able to arm their short and medium-range ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads that could threaten Japan, South Korea, China, Russia. And the security situation in Northeast Asia is going to become more and more difficult. So it's a serious problem. It's not a surprise. Whether North Korea has perfected a hydrogen bomb test, I, too, am skeptical that they have perfected the technology. This appears to be a test of the same yield, relatively smaller yield, as their February 2013 test. But with every test, they will achieve more information, more knowledge to advance their designs.
One of the international responses being considered is more sanctions on North Korea. Do you believe that will do any good?
Well, effective international sanctions are a key part of the equation to confront North Korea about its nuclear weapons transgressions. But I think the key is to enforce existing UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea, particularly by China, its neighbor, its largest trading partner. But that alone is not going to impede or change the North's behavior in a serious way. It can change their interest in getting to the negotiating table, but that alone is not going to be effective. I mean, we've seen now the fourth test since international sanctions have been put in place. There were sanctions before that. We need to negotiate again. We need to re-engage. We can't negotiate out of fear, as President Kennedy once said, but we can't fear to negotiate. And I think that also is necessary and warranted given the grave situation.
Would you say this is as bad as it's gotten?
This is bad. It's hard to compare moments in North Korea's nuclear history. At one point in 1992-93, when their plutonium production program was first discovered, I think the crisis was much graver. There was a real threat that there could be war. There have been other incidents over time that could lead to war between the North and South. I think that this represents a gradual worsening of the situation. It's dangerous in the sense that it is gradual, and we can't afford to have the international community issue condemnations today and tomorrow, and then turn back to other world crises the next day, and not pursue a more effective strategy to halt North Korea's nuclear testing and its ballistic missile testing and its production of plutonium and highly enriched uranium. Its program is still relatively small. Its arsenal is relatively small today, but it's going to become more sophisticated and become larger in the years ahead if we don't freeze their program.
Well, we want to thank you, Daryl Kimball, Executive Director of the Arms Control Association, for taking time this busy day for you to speak with us.
Thank you.
Let's see how people are responding to the North Korea nuclear test on social media. And Michael Lippin joins us here in the studio with more on that. Michael, what's the Twitter reaction like so far?
Hi, Susan. Well, you know, one way to gauge that reaction is by doing a search for some of the popular Twitter hashtags related to the incident. One hashtag that people are using is hashtag nuke test. And here's a tweet from Ian Bremmer, who is a political scientist and a professor at NYU, New York University. He's got 148,000 followers, and he wrote this: North Korea really hates being ignored. Hashtag nuke test. Well, you know, Western cynics often accuse North Korea of acting in an aggressive manner to gain the world's attention and extract humanitarian aid for its starving people. Another hashtag that I've seen today is H-bomb, standing for hydrogen bomb. And one person using it is Peter Dow. He is a former advisor to U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. And he asks a rhetorical question: how scary is it that in 2016, hashtag H-bomb is a trending tag? Another rhetorical question comes from KT McFarland. She is a Fox News national security analyst, and she asks, if North Korea nuke test is an H-bomb, will they sell it to Iran? Now, of course, North Korea and Iran have been longtime allies.
A lot of jokes about something very serious, really. But what are the Chinese state media saying about this test?
Well, the People's Daily, which is a state-run newspaper, tweeted a link to one of its articles saying, DPRK's alleged H-bomb cracks school playground in northeastern China. And in fact, there was the tremor was felt in northeastern China, and the article does talk about how school exams had to be canceled in that region because of the earthquake. Susan?
So the kids were happy, but the teacher was not?
Perhaps.
Okay, thank you very much, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
It's been long known that evolution has guided human development to adapt to changing environments over the years. Now, new findings by U.S. and French researchers suggest that our language abilities have also adapted to our local environment. The researchers examined languages spoken throughout today's world and compared their sound structures with climatic and ecological factors. Ian Madison from the University of New Mexico says that he and his colleagues found that the number of distinct consonants in a language and how they are grouped together are related to the precipitation, temperature, tree cover, and elevation of an area in which the language evolved. The researchers say their findings support a theory which suggests animal species adjust the sounds they make so that they can be transmitted more efficiently in the environment they live in. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Russia has offered to act as an intermediary between Iran and Saudi Arabia following Riyadh's execution of the prominent Shiite cleric Nimr al-Nimr. Joining us on the line from Moscow is Daniel Scharf, our correspondent there. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Oh, thank you. What is this offer coming from Russia?
Well, it's not an official offer in terms of it having been publicly announced, but what we do have are sources in Russia's foreign ministry who've been quoted in Russian state media and also in foreign media as saying that they have made this offer. So it's it is out there. They seem to be just kind of feeling it out to see if they may be able to provide this kind of a service for the two sides or if they would be interested in it. But it has not been officially announced in terms of, you know, really putting it out there for everyone.
Well, this is a little awkward situation because of Russia's relationship with Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, it's, I mean, they've, you know, Russia's been playing this kind of intermediary role to a degree already with the Syria conflict in terms of, you know, trying to get the different sides to the table and really pushing for this grand coalition that it would like to see happen that would include Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But that's this big sticking point between the two sides, of course, because Saudi Arabia wants to see the Syrian president removed from power. They want him to get out of the equation. They believe he's, along with the United States, they believe that he is a big cause of the problem in Syria, whereas Iran is backing him up, and of course Moscow is, because that's their ally.
Yeah, and Russia has been selling arms to Iran.
Yep, they've been a longtime customer of Russian arms sales. We've also seen that stepped up a little bit in terms of wanting to get a particular advanced missile system that they had agreed to some years ago, get that deal hashed out. That's run into some legal problems just between Russia and Iran, but it looks like with the settlement of the nuclear deal that they're going to be able to get that all sorted out. But that, of course, has raised some concerns among Iran's neighbors, such as Israel, and the United States is not so keen to see advanced missile systems go to Iran either. But, of course, Iran has its own ballistic missiles that are being developed, and that's a big concern as well.
This conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia has had ripple effects all through the Middle East. Where does Russia come into this big picture?
Well, Russia certainly wants to get out there and be a big player. Russia wants to be seen as being at the table as not only a regional power, but also as a global power. Of course, you know, Russia does want to see a peaceful settlement to the conflict in Syria because it has its own concerns, not only about its ally in Damascus, but also because there are thousands of Russian citizens who have been fighting alongside the Islamic State terrorists. And there is a concern here in Moscow that when the conflict does come to an end, or if it gets further out of hand, or if they decide to target Russia, that they could come back home and bring some of those fundamentalist militant ideas back to Russia. So that's a big concern as well. So it's a complicated situation, but Russia is certainly involved now, especially with its aerial bombing campaign in Syria. It's really forced itself up to the table in a big way, and also forced the countries involved to really try to come to a quicker solution because of Russia's involvement.
Well, thank you, Daniel, for speaking with us today from Moscow.
My pleasure.
Coming up on International Edition, a place with all the electronic gadgets you could ever dream of, and enjoying some of the musical folks we've lost in the past year.
This year's Consumer Electronics Show is expected to highlight more of the Internet of Things, with devices and delivery systems taking center stage. Robin Raskin is the founder of Living in Digital Times. She says that the sprawling display of electronics shows that what was once fantasy is becoming reality.
Just from a year ago, it's like all the building block pieces have come together towards artificial intelligence, robotics, drones, driverless cars. That was all like sort of science fiction hype just a year ago at CES, virtual reality, and this year it's all real. It's somewhat terrifying, but really exhilarating also.
One time, virtual reality was for gaming only, but now designers and manufacturers have used 360-degree cameras to give viewers a truly immersive real-life experience. Henry Stewart is the co-founder of Visualize, a London-based company that gives users views of events they could not have imagined just last year.
And we capture that by using 360-degree cameras that are essentially balls of cameras, different kinds of cameras for different jobs. And these all capture video at once. We then synchronize the cameras, stitch and blend all the content, and produce a sphere which you can then put into virtual reality in a virtual reality headset and immerse yourself in it and look around.
Stewart's company has produced videos that feature a rock band in concert, a passenger's eye view of a Lamborghini driving the coast of Italy, and what it's like from the outside of London's building, The Shard.
A And so you've got this 36-hour time-lapse looking over London, seeing the clouds rush in, seeing the weather change, seeing the day and the night cycle. And it's really stunning. And so for the Shard, it means that they can go to tourism expos around the world and encourage tourism, you know, to visit and see this incredible view for yourself.
Robots are expected to make a big splash at this year's CES as well. In the past, many of the robots have been more toy-like, but Robin Raskin says designers are rolling out concepts for robots that are more like personal assistants.
And I'm thinking of an aging population saying, go get that bottle, or open this jar for me, or can you help me take my blood pressure? So you're going to see really useful robots, physician's assistant robots, articulating arms, manufacturing. So the practical uses of robotics, as well as the entertaining ones.
And auto lovers can look for the latest in automotive technology this week, including more advances toward driverless or autonomous cars. Faraday Future made a splash with its concept car, the FF01, which utilizes the company's variable platform architecture, the same undercarriage and batteries that can be modified for a variety of vehicles, from a race car to an SUV. Nick Sampson is Faraday's Senior Vice President of Research and Development and Product Development.
Over the past 18 months, we've assembled an extraordinary group of over 550 talented individuals in California, plus 200 more globally. We're working literally night and day to reimagine, rethink, and create an entirely new concept for mobility.
The 2016 Consumer Electronics Show runs through January 9th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
At an elder care facility in Pennsylvania, Alzheimer's patient Desi Assisi dances to 1940s-era music with her companion. The Easton home recently installed an old-time kitchen and living room to help enliven dementia patients. Dr. Jason Karlowish.
The benefits of reminiscence therapy is that it taps into memories that are well-learned, memories that are attached not just to a fact, but also to a smell, to images, to music.
The therapy is working for Olga Deacon, who has dementia. She often spends time in the kitchen telling stories of her childhood to her granddaughter, Chris Boyce.
I've learned more about her in the 2 months she's been here than I think I knew before that.
Caregivers say that reminiscence therapy won't alter the course of Alzheimer's or dementia, but it can improve mood and behavior by focusing on the patient's enjoyment of life. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
As the music world still reels from the loss of singing great Natalie Cole, VOA's Jim Stevenson looks back at 2015 with Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald to remember some of the iconic musicians who remain with us only through their recordings. It's my party and I'll cry if I want to, cry if I want to, cry if I want to. You would cry too if it happened to you.
Jim, we lost a lot of great musical talent, and a few of them were especially important to me. Mm-hmm. Back in February, Leslie Gore, who sang It's My Party, passed away from cancer at age 68. And Leslie was really one of the pioneering feminists in pop music. And It's My Party is interesting because it was one of Quincy Jones' first productions. Another great artist who died in 2015 was Percy Sledge. Mm. And he sang When a Man Loves a Woman. I guess you could say that Percy was a one-hit wonder, but what a hit, because that's one of the enduring songs of the past half century. Percy died of cancer in April at 74. Another of the great soul singers from the early 60s was Benny King. He did Stand By Me. He died of natural causes in April at age 76. And in May, B.B. King passed away at age 89. Now, B.B. had been suffering from diabetes for many years, but he still maintained a tireless touring schedule. I mean, he was playing his guitar Lucille right up to the end. And what a great recorded legacy he's going to leave behind. Another great musician was jazz saxophonist Ornette Coleman. I mean, he never had any pop hits, but he was incredibly influential in the field of jazz. And he died of cardiac arrest in June at age 85. And then the month of December brought two huge losses to the rock community. On December 3rd, Scott Weiland passed away from cardiac arrest. He was found dead on his tour bus. He was 48 years old. Scott had sung with Stone Temple Pilots and Velvet Revolver. He was on tour with his latest band, The Wildabouts. And then on Monday the 28th, Lemmy Kilmister, the leader of Motorhead, died of cancer at age 70. Mm-hmm. And so I want to tip my hat to all of these great musicians who left us in 2015.
Absolutely. And we are fortunate because we are the beneficiaries of all the recorded music that they left behind. And we will continue to listen to all of that.
It's a cliche often to say they live on, but they do.
And, you know, you talk about artists who not only were big in their own right, but had such deep influences throughout the industry. Alan Toussaint also passing away this year.
Yes, absolutely. And Alan Toussaint, by the way, if you're a fan of New Orleans music, you should check out Dave Grohl's documentary, Sonic Highways, where the Foo Fighters go to eight different cities around the United States and record there and talk with figures in their city's musical histories. Alan Toussaint was very prominently featured in the New Orleans episode.
Go out and check the top 20 each week right here on VOA with Ray McDonald. And you can find him on Twitter.
Ray on the hits.
Thanks so much, Ray, for stopping by. Have a happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Jim.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner and scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, is awarding more than $8.4 million in grants and cooperative agreements this year to support conservation projects and scientific studies that benefit coral reef management across seven U.S. states and territories, the Caribbean and Micronesia. All of these projects focus on priority coral reef regions and watersheds, addressing three primary threats: global climate change, land-based sources of pollution, and unsustainable fishing practices. Funded projects include grants to reduce sediment and improve water quality in U.S. Virgin Islands, work with communities in Hawaii to address threats to coral reefs, support coral reef ecosystem conservation in Puerto Rico, and strengthen outreach and education efforts. Projects also include work to assess coral reef resiliency to climate change in multiple locations. Earlier this year, NOAA declared the third global coral bleaching event. While corals can recover from mild bleaching, severe or long-term bleaching is often lethal, especially when combined with other threats. Healthy coral reefs are important to all of us. Conservation of these resources is a key factor in the resilience of coastal communities, said Jennifer Koss, director of the NOAA Coral Reef Conservation Program. The projects funded through NOAA's grants program allow us to strengthen our ties with local partners, address the most pressing threats to corals, and broaden our conservation efforts. Nearly half of the funds awarded this year directly support coral reef conservation projects led by state and territorial resource management agencies. Other conservation projects are led by non-governmental organizations, community groups, and academic partners. A limited number of international projects focused in Micronesia, Mesoamerica, and the wider Caribbean region were also supported. It's exciting to fund smart and innovative projects led by partners who are working across disciplines to make a positive impact on the condition of the world's coral reefs, said Jenny Waddell, coordinator of the NOAA Coral Reef Conservation Program's grants portfolio. There are surely a lot of challenges ahead for coral reefs, but by studying, managing, and conserving them in a collaborative way, we are all helping to ensure coral reefs continue to survive and thrive.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.